There is no other cause that has produced so many deaths and so many crimes than the cause of God. In the name of God, human beings have killed, have fought, have battled each other more than for any other reason. So when I saw the title of this panel, Cause or Cover of Violence, I thought I could say yes. It's either cause or cover for violence, but it is the main factor in the violence of human beings, which is very sad. If we go through history, we can talk about holy wars, the Crusades, we can talk about ISIS, contemporary phenomenon. It is all related to religious intolerance and to the desire of religions to establish themselves in an ever-growing geographical and population sphere. I think that the information age has stimulated the growth of fundamentalism. And I'm not talking about any particular religion. I think it is general in many religions, in most religions. I grew up as a Jew, and we have Jewish fundamentalism that we can see in many places of the world. We can see it in New York. We can see it in Chicago. We can see it in Belgium, in Israel, of course. Intolerance towards others. We can see Christians who are fundamentalists, Catholics. We can see, obviously, Muslims who are fundamentalists. Probably, I said yesterday, the Jewish fundamentalists have not produced the violence that other groups have produced because their number is so small. There are very few Jews in the world, so it would be impossible to produce violence. But when we talk about Christianity and we talk about Islam, their number is so overwhelming that even if a small percentage of their members are violent, fundamentalist violent, it has an impact on the world because we're talking about millions. We're talking about billions in both cases, but millions that could be violent. So it is not, I don't intend to blame believers or religious people for violence and crimes against humanity, but I do believe that certain tendencies in those religions, through the information age, through social media, through common media, have stimulated extremist views that we call fundamentalism and a great deal of intolerance. In the name of God, they go through violent means to either defend themselves or persuade others of their faith. Now we have leaders, religious leaders, who are good examples of the contrary. And I would like to cite two examples. Pope Francis is certainly a pacific person, as is the Dalai Lama. So we have leaders in all these religions, like these two extraordinary personalities in the world, who go against, and there are many imams and who are also in this situation. But the fact is that unfortunately, the religions have been either a cause, direct cause, or a cover for violence. Thank you.
Thanks, Pablo. I think in my comments I'll want to build on what Pablo is saying, but maybe take it to another level or add some detail. But I hope we can come back to – I hadn't thought about our information age that we're in and the dynamics at that place. So maybe that's something we can come back to in discussion or in question and answer. The first thing I want to say is that, I mean, this question is certainly not new about religion, cause or cover of violence. One thing I suppose we have to be careful of is the way we even pose that question or begin to talk about it, whether we are adding legitimacy to those who use violence in the name of religion, i.e., a Hindu fanatic or a Muslim fanatic will say, yes, it's all about religion, but a fellow Muslim or a fellow Hindu will say, it's not about Hinduism or Islam at all. So that's obviously where the tension lies. And so we don't want to talk about religion in a way that smooths over that tension. And just to lay, some examples on the table, we are obviously in contemporary world talking about things like ISIS, like currently the Hindutva movement in India, where even as we speak, there's violence occurring. Certain forms of Zionism, certain forms of the Christian right, the Right to Life movement. There are some Christians who advocate violence for that cause and so forth. So I think right away we're getting down to a point that I want to go to about first this idea of cover or legitimation or using religion to legitimize violence. And here I just want to throw up, I'm an academic, so I throw out references to a lot of other academic work. I'm intrigued by a thesis put forward by a colleague of mine, a French colleague, Olivier Roy, who talks about the Islamicization of radicalism. And he's basically saying that a lot of, let's say, young people who turn to violence in the name of Islam and so forth, it hasn't been Islam that has radicalized them. They were often violent people in the first place. A lot of people who've conducted terrorist acts, particularly in Europe, have criminal records and have spent time in prison for violent acts already. And they learn about Islam or a particular reading of Islam in prison and come out as violent people with a new narrative or a new cause. And so this is, Hua is of this sort that's saying, okay, that's what we should look at, is this using religion to legitimize acts of violence that people might be conducting anyways as violent people. We don't want to get into the psychology of all this, but there's a lot of work being done about radicalization these days, and that's where they're focusing on the kind of psychology of that. I'm not sure if I'm quite with that. I'm an anthropologist. I have to put my hand up, so we're always a bit suspicious of psychologists. So there's that one view, okay, that religion is just a legitimation of other violence going on. And let's face it, in history, there was a long, the study of history, there's a long kind of camp, a particularly Marxist or critical theory camp, that looked on the Crusades in this way, saying that, well, no, really what the Crusades were all about were these nobles and landowners who didn't like the fact that Muslims took over the trade routes and blocked the trade routes in the Middle East, and that's what they wanted to get to, open up the trade routes, control resources, get a hold of all that wealth over there. And they just used religion for their purposes of doing that. That was a long-standing kind of theory in history. I think a lot more contemporary history, at least some things that I've come across by colleagues, are saying, no, actually, the Crusades were done by fanatics. They really did believe a religious narrative going there, i.e. that by participating in this Christian crusade, that they and their family members, both current and dead, would have a guaranteed place in heaven. Okay? So we're starting to shift away from just this sheer idea of legitimizing violence to something perhaps a bit more causal, if you see what I mean. And so I just wanted to pick that up, that the Crusades or several of these other forms of current religious violence, ISIS, Hindutva, and so forth, I would call them narratives, That's where I really want to focus. That would be the kind of key word or take-home message that I'll try to have here. Particular narratives that provide people with meaning and what I would call sanctioned purpose to do violent acts. Okay? It's not about the core of the religion. It's a particular narrative based on that core of religion that gives people the sanction from up above, from the ultimate, from the priesthood and so forth, to have a purpose in their life. And let's face it, the people who conduct these acts, who kill themselves for this, have a pretty deep purpose there. But it's a purpose built on a particular narrative. And so that's where I would say, I would come down more on the cover side then, if that's what we want to call a particular narrative of religion. It's not the religion doing the thing. It's a reading. And so therefore, I'll just end my statements because we want to hear the others and get on to discussion. Again, referring to another colleague, another academic, who's a real kind of premier figure in the study of religious violence, Mark Juergensmeyer from University of California, Santa Barbara. The way he puts it is, when we're talking about this kind of violence, religion is not the problem, but it is problematic. There is a narrative drawing on religion. It's not the religion itself. And so that's where let's pick apart the narratives and how people imbibe those narratives to get the legitimation, to get the sanctions, to do the violent acts that they want to do. Okay, I get there.
All right, am I close enough? Yes, I think I am. It's nice to be back here, and this topic, among other topics this week, are the kinds of things that keep me up at night thinking about these issues. So what I want to start off is a little comparative sense. So I want you to think along with me in the beginning. How do we imagine God as the foundation for those of us who come from a faith community? So do you imagine, if you think to yourself as a child, however you were raised, did you see and do you see God as love, God as just, God as a rule giver, God that takes revenge, God that must be defended? Or were you raised in a way where you say there is no God? So reflect about that for just a minute of what were your earliest images of these issues? What was your concept, basically, of how does the world work based on these early images that you had? As it was mentioned in my bio, for really almost 5 years, I had the opportunity to live and immerse myself in a totally different culture that not only made me have this wonderful opportunity to really try to understand and embrace what I was hearing around me, but all of you who've traveled overseas know that when you do something like this, it also makes you look afresh at your own country, your own faith, your own experiences in life. So for me, I learned my images of God in a very small New England Christian religion that said God is love. That's what I learned. That's how I approached life, very optimistic. I was raised in a way that we didn't read those parts of the Bible that challenged that concept in terms of revenge and rules and laws and the difficult parts of the Old Testament. My faith tradition only recorded the happy moments. When I got to Saudi Arabia, I was at that stage in my life where I knew I was going to be becoming a grandmother pretty soon. And so I was looking at this issue now from the beginning of life to as I approached the last years of my life. And in Saudi Arabia, I was confronted with the notion of God very different. The first key thing, and I think it affects all of our images here, and it's so hard as an American for me to really truly embrace this and understand it. It was the first thing that was told to me when I started talking to Saudi women and became friends, and we still are. That Islam is life itself. It is life. There is no distinction between mosque and state. There is no something that you do it on Friday or you do it on Saturday or you do it on Sunday. It was a different type of idea. Again, there is no distinction between government and religion. It was life. Islam is life itself. And with that was the idea, sometimes vaguely stated or in a general way, sometimes very specifically stated, that Islam was under threat. It needed to be defended. It was under pressure. And that at times, and I'm going to be on another panel talking about this more directly, but at times I had the sense that there was such a concern about this threat idea that everything had to be preserved in the practice of the faith in a very, very orderly way, and that anything that would vary from that structure, for example, letting women drive, wasn't perceived as a question about women driving. It was thought of in the context of that allows mixing, it's an offense to the moral structure of Islam, and if you allowed that, there was this impression that the entire faith structure would fall apart. It was a strange sense of fragility. So I want to just make a few comments today about these two experiences I've had in my life, one being raised in this uniquely in New England kind of religion. You kind of went off in a room by yourself and prayed, and then experiencing a different approach to this. Now, in my bio notes, it also mentions that for 17 years I taught at the War College. And one interesting thing we did, and I urge you, if you're interested in this topic, to read a Catholic priest named Brian Hare, who teaches at Harvard Divinity School and at the JFK School. He would come every year, sometimes twice a year, to give a lecture on just war. So from the Christian and in Western traditions, we have to reconcile, especially at the War College, I'm teaching military officers before they become generals, how do you reconcile in our own religious traditions the commandment that says do not kill and the ones saying from your ruler, you must kill? How do you reconcile that? So Catholic tradition goes on at length in an intricate way to try to resolve that conflict. And in resolving it, they set up, and Father Hare is an excellent lecturer, and I would urge you to watch him on YouTube. He really very specifically goes down the criteria for under what circumstance, just war, under what circumstance can you fight, and in what way can you fight? How do you conduct yourself in war? So when we talk about Syria right now and chemical weapons, that touches something in us that says that is not right. That's not a right way to fight war. After 9/11, I was teaching at the War College that morning. I could see the Pentagon burning. And I was department chair at that point. And I knew we were entering a new strategic era. We were entering an era that could confound us, frankly. But the first thing I did was, in addition to having Father Hare come every year, I also asked and then urged, I was leaving actually at that point to go to another state, but I urged my department chair who came after me to find an Islamic scholar who could talk about Islamic concepts of just war. In the West, our images of religious war, I think for all of us, suggest to us, and you mentioned it, more people are killed in the name of God. We imagine a religious-based war to be violent, horrible, no limitation. You're fighting for God. You're fighting to defend God. So how we approach, is religion a cause or a cover? The question is, how do we imagine, again, our concept of what needs to be defended and protected? Let me just finish with one thing and we can get back to Q's and A's. As this era began with Islamic violence, at one point, I said somewhat jokingly, but I'm thinking about this. The War College has military officers and diplomats. I suggested we kick them all out. We don't have any more fighter pilots and submarine guys. We should just have the chaplains. Because if we're saying we are in a contest to struggle right now, do we need to bring some expertise and knowledge about what we're talking about? Thanks a lot.
So I'm the chaplain, and I'm not sure that's a good idea. I have to begin by saying you didn't know this, but I grew up Jewish too, so we have that in common. And that's maybe relative to what we're talking about. as a person who grew up as a Jew, became a Christian, I said this morning in another panel, there are two kinds of converts. There are the people who get really excited and then insist that you be like them. And they're the people who remember where they came from and it's still part of who they are. I like to think at least I'm in the latter camp. And at least I wrestle a lot with what that means. One of the strange things about us human beings, when we start to talk about the infinite and try to wrestle with paradox, is that we can only sort of grasp it for a little bit, and then we start to put a box around it and make it concrete, and then we get into the bind of thinking, well, okay, I believe this, you believe that, so one of us must be wrong. In fact, that is not necessarily the case. It is possible for me to believe something, for you to believe something different, and for us both to be right, or wrong for that matter. But that is a concept that from time immemorial, humanity has had difficulty dealing with. And so we have had religious wars that you can point to over time. For a long time. At the same time, many of those wars, as Steve, I think, rightly says, many of those are under the pretext of religious belief, but in fact are carried out for a whole variety of different reasons. So I want to talk first about the ones that are carried out for religious reasons and suggest that while we immediately go to the big examples, we when we think about religious violence, we go immediately to ISIS and to major wars and so on. Like charity, violence begins at home. And what I said earlier about our difficulty in imagining that someone who believes something different from what we believe might also be right or might be right when we aren't really begins with the way we relate to one another one-on-one. If we decry ISIS, but spend our time battling with each other and can't manage to have civil discourse ourselves, we're hypocrites. So, you know, I urge us to think in the microcosmic as well as the macrocosmic. On the subject of war as a pretext, or religion, rather, as a pretext, as a justification for war. I think we need to be careful about how we brand other people's religion. I said this morning, and it's the reason I think that Janet pointed to me when she referred to it. We hear a lot about the violence of the Quran. It astonishes me when that comes out of the mouth of a Jew or a Christian, because I wonder whether they've ever read the Bible, which is certainly a deeply violent text. So, you know, as I read this question, I kept thinking, this seems to be the question, a question about other people's war, not ours. Our wars are legitimate, right? But other people are, you know, covering it with religion. You know, War and violence are war and violence. And all societies are guilty of it. And I have to say that one of the other speakers with whom I had lunch said, you know, we talk about religious violence. There's plenty of state violence, for goodness sake. And that also has a kind of pretext. The issue for us, I think, is to really begin to think about why things become violent. I'll stop there.
We next ask our panelists to comment on each other's comments.
Okay.
You want to start, Temple?
Sure.
I think it's true that religion can legitimize violence. But it is also true, and this is dangerous, that violence can delegitimize a religion, which is occurring with Muslims today. I don't think Islam is worse or better than any other religion. But it can be delegitimized because of our perception of the violence, whatever the motivation is. That's one thing. Something else. We're not talking about God. At least I'm not. I'm talking about religion, not God. Because then we would have to say that God is evil, and that is absurd. Even for those who don't believe in God, it is not an evil figure. It's a good figure. That is how we were educated. So we're talking about religion. That is a different thing than God. The religion uses the name of God in order to do certain things. And even those that look for an excuse to be violent in the name of God, they're using the religion. They're using the religion. Islam is life, government and mosque. In Saudi Arabia it is that, but not in the Philippines and not in Indonesia and not in Pakistan. In fact, not in most countries, Muslim countries, there is a secularization of government, a secularization of the state. So it is not, the problem with ISIS is that the concept of a caliphate means state or nation and religion united. And there, of course, you confuse patriotism or nationalism with religious predominance or sanctity. I would say that. I when I talk about fundamentalism, I talk about intolerance, lack of respect for the other. Of course, I believe in not only tolerance, but respect for everybody else. So the intolerance is what takes us to extremes and makes us become violent in any respect, not only religious.
I suppose I'd like to have follow-up comments on two things. I suppose, well, let's just put this out here as a proposition. Does it make sense to, even when talking about violence, to keep religious-inspired war on one side and other acts of violence on the other side? Are the same dynamics and processes at work? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there. Because I suppose what I was talking about in my comments about certain narratives giving people sanctioned purpose, well, for me, for what do you call it, non-war acts of violence. So pogroms against people. So I'm talking about, again, something like Hindutva right now, Muslims being killed and beaten up and so forth, Christians being killed and beaten up in India. Other acts of violence, of course, small terrorist acts, the people who drive vans into crowds now and these sorts of things. Are the same dynamics going on there as on these larger levels? I don't know. I just throw that out there. But again, in terms of acts of violence, it's religious-inspired acts of violence, or what I'm talking about, narratives that legitimize acts of violence. Let's also bear in mind that these other acts of violence are not necessarily interreligious, i.e., I think as many or more people have been, more Muslims have been killed by ISIS and Al-Qaeda than non-Muslims being killed and terrorized because people like ISIS or certain Muslim Brotherhood narratives and so forth saying you aren't Muslim enough or you're not a good Muslim in my eyes, and so this legitimizes acts of violence, this kind of sanctioned purpose. So let's bear in mind that, yeah, religious violence isn't always just between religions. And the final thing I just want to throw out there is, again, going back to Pablo's original comments about we have to realize that in this information age that we're in, certainly these kinds of narratives now, I would suggest, are tremendously exacerbated and heightened by social media and internet platforms and so forth. We know about all sorts of things from politics in the U.S. and elsewhere about how easy it is to create, you know, so-called echo chambers of people, you know, social networks and media platforms and internet platforms where you go to hear the same thing that legitimizes your view. And of course, ISIS have become masters at echo chambers, at fundamentalist echo chambers, showing extremely violent images as part of their narrative now. And these extremely violent images speak to people who are looking for this kind of sanctioned purpose and violent acts and so forth. So I think this is adding to all of our views and knowledge about the history of religious violence, now we're in an age of kind of accelerated or heightened narratives that legitimize religious violence, I'd say.
I'd like to throw out the question, to what extent is this issue gendered? And I guess to be fantastic about it, if women were running the world, do I need to ask the rest of the question? And it's not an idle question. We are, you've talked about change in terms of the information explosion, but there is change. Patriarchy really is on its way out. It may take a time. It's not a straight line, folks, I'm sorry to say, but it's going to happen. What kind of effect is that going to have on this issue?
I remember when I was first in Saudi, I was trying to learn Arabic, and I asked the question of my language professor who was teaching me, when you're making reference to God, is the pronoun he, she, we, what is it? And when I said the word she, he was like, so I think there is an aspect, and I just want to make another comment before we get into gender. On the issue of God versus religion, again, how it sounded to me when I was there. I'm used to making that distinction. And I'm used to when I came, I took religion 101 when I was a freshman in college, and I learned about the political institution of the Catholic Church. I never thought of it as a political institution before, but, how do religions structure themselves? The different sense I got in Saudi was the idea, and if you just contemplate this for a while, not only are you praying 5 times a day, but you make reference to whatever is happening in terms of if God wills it. That phrase is a repeated phrase in almost every sentence of life, every day. So the idea of this is that, and I have proposed this at some dinners when we've had these deeper discussions, if you are raised in a way to believe that it is the one final revelation of God, this is God's word to you in the Quran, this is the final revelation, and this is it. Everything else is not right. I have asked the question of how much is intolerance a requirement in the faith structure? Is it required? And that's worth, I think, a discussion. I think it's a discussion we need to have in terms of everyone what are our concepts of this? And the last just comment about this, and I've mentioned this before in other settings, whenever a terrorist is captured, either before an event or after, but they've lived, and they've been asked the question, why did you do this? The answer almost always is, I need to defend Islam. I'm defending Islam. And what occurred to me living in Saudi was that that question, that answer always seemed to require the fist. And why didn't it ever seem to inspire the mind? Why couldn't you defend Islam intellectually? And that, I think, is part of the aspect of this puzzle we're all looking at, both Muslims themselves as well as people who practice Islam in different countries and have a different interpretations. Obviously, Saudi Arabia is the home of the two holy mosques, the two holy sites. People come for religious pilgrimage to that country. So the tension here right now that you're seeing, we feel, is happening within the faith, and it gets expressed in these concepts of violence, cause, or cover.
I guess we're ready for questions. The first question, I'll warn the panel, is historical, and it requires that I repeat the title of our panel. The title, again, is Religion, Cause or Cover of Violence. The question is, has the answer to this question changed over time? Was there ever a time that religion was more of a cause or more of a cover of violence than today?
In the audience?
Well, I mean, so there was an age of religious wars, 1556 to 1689 in Europe. I'm only talking Europe right now. So that was the era of religious wars, Protestants versus Catholics. And as in the War College we teach this, that the seminal event was the Treaty of Westphalia, those of you who remember your history. The Treaty of Westphalia said we have to end these religious wars, and it established the principle of sovereignty. And so if you're king, you're king of a country, what you do within your own country is your business. We are not going to invade your country and try to convert you from Protestantism, from Episcopalianism to Presbyterianism. We're not going to do that. So that concept in history, as the Europeans approached it, was essentially an exhaustion over this effort to try to convert, to try to win over, change
but
your hearts and minds.
How much of that was religious and how much was political?
As a political person myself, to me, all of life is politics. As long as human beings are involved, we try to influence, pressure, and persuade each other. So that's, yes, both.
Can I give it a try? In 1492, the Spanish conquered America. They had a priest to their right in the cross of the Catholic Church, and, of course, some sort of armament in the other hand. But the Spanish colonization of America, of Spanish America, was done with the church as an instrument of colonization. It caused some deaths. It was violent, even if it didn't cause all the deaths that it could have caused, because it was an imposition, a violent imposition of a doctrine, in this case, a religious doctrine, and it was brought by Europeans. The Portuguese did the same. So I don't know to answer that question, whether it's more now than before. But certainly we know more about religious-inspired wars than before because of the Internet, because of globalization. We're more aware and more conscious of it.
I think one of the issues here is whose side we think God is on. And, you know, you could get away with God being on your side, with thinking God was on your side when people like you were the only people you came into contact with. We live in a different kind of world today in which, like it or not, we're constantly coming into contact with other people. I mentioned in the panel this morning the passage that Christians will read Saturday night at the Easter Vigil of the charioteers, the Egyptian charioteers being tossed into the sea as the Israelites escaped across the Red Sea. When you read that, when I read it, I think, you know, what about the charioteers? They were, you know, all they were doing was acting on behalf of the Pharaoh. Are they not God's children too? God tossed these people into the sea. I have a little problem with that. But I have a problem with that because, you know, I think of Egyptians as human beings like me. But if you never, you know, if your whole mindset is that you're really never in touch with the other, then you can sort of get away with saying, well, God's on your side. God will fight with us against those guys. In the world in which we live, that's a little hard to hold up.
Next question. Is fundamentalism a function of modernity? If so, how do you determine causality?
Yeah. Thank you.
My first response is it's above my pay grade. You know, reading a text, or a religious text, a holy text, literally, and I do agree with what you said, by the way. I found it helpful in Saudi Arabia to read Deuteronomy and Leviticus over and over and over again. Because those are two rule-making chapters of the Bible, and that also is expressed in the way Islam was practiced. So fundamentalism, and it goes back to what you said, obviously the issue is, for us as humans, is identity. Religion gives cause for war, but I would also argue it gives comfort. Right? We're dealing with life and death and violence. And our identity, especially if you believe in Day of Judgment and end of life questions, do you feel as you approach that you have done something that justifies going to heaven, that has your credentials for that? So fundamentalism in terms of do you attach certain values to a very, you know, literal interpretation of whatever your religious background is, does that provide comfort?
That's a tough one because, I mean, we'd have to, unpack modernity and all of this. But I would certainly be on the side of the argument saying, yes, there's some things about fundamentalism that are absolutely part and parcel of the age that we live, that the kinds of narratives that I keep going back to, you remember my kind of take-home message or keyword, could only have happened within the last 200 years or so. The types of absolutism, the types of wedding of political messages with interweaving with religious messages, the types of striking out against, let's say, with certain forms of Hindu fundamentalism, striking out against the West and Western forms and so forth, these are very modern phenomena. You wouldn't have found the same narratives 500 years ago. So I think there is something, contemporary, and social scientists and historians are working on this one.
Well, it does seem to me at least some I wouldn't want to talk about all fundamentalism. I get nervous about that. But certainly some fundamentalism in a number of religious environments has arisen in the context of everything I just talked about. The fact that walls are breaking down and people there's a lot of diversity in our lives. The fact that patriarchy is threatened. It seems to me in an environment in which the old order is threatened, the first response tends to be a rigid one to protect the old order. That rigid response tends to be brittle, and ultimately fragile.
Next question, please comment on sexual violence and religion.
They all got it.
I can give you one observation that might surprise you. In the years we lived in Riyadh, actually the daughter of the king who's passed on now, but King Abdullah, led the effort to take on the issue of domestic violence. And if you Google it, You'll see some unbelievably powerful graphics they did of a woman in an abaya and a niqab, but with a black eye. And so there was an acknowledgement that, yes, violent patterns have to be addressed. And, you know, a whole program was set up to save houses and support systems for women in that situation. Some would go back to tribal, you know, traditions and culture, not just religion, where in a very harsh culture like Saudi Arabia, there was a certain image of where women should be, kind of hold away in the tent, away from other eyes. The dynamic that happens when you're in a very compressed place in a tent in the heat of the desert. But there has been a very active, and it continues on, a very active program on addressing the domestic violence within that country.
Well, I was a little bit flipped there, but think about the number of ways in which almost every religion has operated to preserve male authority. Mm-hmm. And that certainly is, I mean, that goes hand, sexual violence is about power, not sex.
Yeah, and fear.
Well, again, I'm that real fear of sounding like a broken record here going on about narratives and sanctioned purpose, but certainly we can find all sorts of evidence of, again, particular narratives that legitimize or give sanction to certain cause of kinds of sexual violence. I'm thinking particularly, I don't know if you know, not so long ago in Russia, at the behest and pressure from the Eastern Orthodox Church, which is very close with Putin now, they've thrown out laws about domestic violence. It's okay for men to abuse their wives. They won't go to court now. And this was largely, again, coming from a particular religious narrative right now of the Eastern Orthodox Church. So,
what was the rationale?
A true Orthodox,
well,
you know, a family, it's an image of a family structure and how it should be with patriarchy, with the man at the top, and what he says goes.
Order.
Yeah.
Another question. Please comment on martyrdom. Martyrdom.
Nonsense.
Well, we hear it in the concept, obviously, of Islam, but also I have to say, don't we all, though, it does touch something in us when we say that person, I don't want my son to have died in vain. He was involved in Vietnam, he's involved in Kuwait, whatever the war was. We do give meaning in life to say you died for a purpose. So in the religious context, yes, I gave up my life for my religion. In a nationalist context, I gave up my life for American freedom or for the king if you're in a different country or for Marxism if you were fighting for the Soviet Union. But there is something I think it touches in us that we don't want a life given in conflict to be given in vain.
All right, another question. This one is actually directed at specifically to Professor Ratovic. How do you explain the fact that over 65% of Egyptian and Palestinian Muslims believe violence is justified for insulting their religion, according to a Pew poll?
For insulting?
I wouldn't attempt to justify it. You know, I mentioned anthropologists not being crazy about psychologists. We're not crazy about polls either. Again, I would have to look at, and I would still say it's down to the narratives. There's nothing inherent about being a Palestinian Muslim that's going to make you think a certain way. There's something inherent about if you sign up to a particular narrative that makes you think that way. And so this is what I just want to be sure to move away from these kind of, you know, the session we were on this morning about religious diversity. We have to move away from the kind of groupist thinking about particular entire religious groups, even national religion groups or something. There's a huge variation, and there are people who differentially sign up for different interpretations. And yeah, maybe indeed 65% of a particular population has signed up to a particular narrative. Yeah, but there's still 45%? Am I doing the maths right? 35%? I'm an anthropologist. I don't do numbers. That don't. So it's, yeah, again, you know, it's an awful academic cop-out. We always just say it's complicated.
This is a question that's specifically directed to Dr. Breslin-Smith. How do we best go about showing the positive aspects of Islam, other faiths, or countries with strong religious connotations, even when faith may be used as a basis for more oppressive practices?
Well, I'm confused. How do we as Americans? Let's say it again.
It just says, how do we? It doesn't, how do we best mean, well, I think just it means that in the abstract, we thinkers. I'm guessing.
I mean, the one issue, the struggle that I see, and it's before Muslims right now, is that it's from my own perspective of this issue, granted given from a Saudi foundation. I've been to Indonesia, I've been to other Muslim nations, but I've lived the longest there, so I really try to understand the mindset. And to me, the region itself is in crisis. Migration, starvation, misery, death, destruction. It's hard to find good news in the Middle East. And as I look at this, I say, we happen to be alive right now at a period where this culture and this religion is under intense pressure internally in a debate within itself on profound existential questions about faith. These are the deepest questions a person can have in a faith tradition. And so what I'm waiting for and what I see some signs of, and we talked about that in your panel, Willow talked about it, is the beginning efforts of Muslims themselves to come together and probe each other's feelings. How do we feel about the issue of intolerance? How do we feel about the issue of corruption? How do we feel about the issue of justice? These types of questions, the ideas of mankind, what we learn when we take philosophy, those questions are on the plate right now for the broader Islamic community, but specifically in the Gulf and in the Middle East, because it involves deep personal discussion. And that discussion right now is always dicey because there is a cultural inhibition against sharing those questioning, those approaches. I used to say, one observation used to come to me of my Catholic friends that I had in school. When they would come to college, they almost always would tell me the same reflection, that they were really raised by strong, let's say, Irish Catholic parents, and they went to Mass every Sunday, and they did everything they should do to be good Catholic kids. They go to college, they go to CU, they take a religion class, and they don't go to Mass the next Sunday, and they're waiting for God to strike them down. Lightning does not appear. And then for most of them, they go through a period of reflection of what did they really love about the way they were raised? What values do they have that are meaningful for them? And usually at the end of college or by the time they're in their 20s and 30s or raising children maybe, and they evaluate what they still want to retain in their Catholic tradition or their Episcopalian tradition or their Jewish tradition, and what would they let go of? In all the years I lived in Riyadh, I never heard that experience expressed. It may have been felt personally and not expressed, but I never heard it expressed. So that's one of the things as I try to get my mind about this. We assume that's part of growing up, a natural part of life, transitions. I'm not sure what happens when it's not.
Here's an interesting challenge. To what extent is religion a solution to violence as well as part of the problem?
Somebody else. Well, I mean, I'm now retired, but if I were still working, my job would be to say, of course, you know. I think it is when we remember, and the we I'm talking here is people like me who have an opportunity to lead communities of faith, to remember that what we're about is not an enterprise in which I tell you what it is we believe and we move on with that, but that religion is an enterprise in which everybody is collaborating to try to figure out what it's all about. And when we do that, I think we make room for peace.
Yeah, maybe I'll try this one out. I'm thinking of, you know, some of the discussions we had at this religious diversity panel this morning as well. And thinking about comments, well, also comments that Janet made as well, that, I mean, to what extent in certain religious understandings is there you were calling it a kind of built-in intolerance? And I would think certain understandings of religion are like that. My religion is right, and automatically yours is wrong. And that's a problem. That's not going to bring any solutions. But I think, Frank, what I think you were also kind of moving towards this morning is that of course there are many understandings of whatever faith you're in that say, this is my faith, this set of beliefs and structures and so forth, do it for me, but there, I recognize that there are other ones that do it for you, and that's okay, but I'm sticking to mine. And that's different from what you're saying, no, mine is better than yours, you have to believe mine. There are certainly understandings, if you see what I'm saying, that I'm okay, you're okay, we're both on different paths. I don't know if you want to elaborate on that, but I think that was your kind of message as well.
Well, you know, we got to remember that what religion is about is trying to wrestle with the infinite. And we so easily get away from that. We sort of, oh, yeah, well, I've done that. I'm an Episcopalian, so I know what that means. Now I go about doing religion. I think religion really works when it keeps wrestling with the infinite. And that's not an easy thing to do. It's sometimes a painful thing to do. But it's how we keep growing, and it's how we keep remembering that the part of the journey is making connections with people who really aren't like us and who aren't thinking like us and who don't even agree with us.
And also just to specifically on the Christian tradition, if you think about it in the context of that region of the world, where revenge is the definition, can be the definition of justice, the statements in the New Testament about loving your enemies and turning the other cheek are revolutionary concepts in that context. So to do that, to say, I mean, I was trying to imagine if President Bush, after 9/11, had gone on television and said, this happened, this horrible loss of life, but I, as a Christian, I'm looking at guidance from the way I was raised as George Bush, I think he's a Methodist, I forgot what he is, but a Protestant, and he would say, the Bible says, the New Testament says, we must love our enemies. When I used to raise this issue at the War College, I mean, my officer students would look at me like, you know, incomprehensible. But we do have these religious traditions, right? That is in the New Testament, those concepts. We also have the concept of war in the Bible. So, yes, those of you who come from that tradition of peacemakers, there is guidance within the Bible and the New Testament for that activity.
We actually did it. I don't want to present the Marshall Plan as a New Testament, you know, turn the other cheek plan. But, you know, there was all kinds of good economics behind the Marshall Plan. But the fact is, the West managed to come together in a way that, you know, it's rare. If we had done a Marshall Plan after 9/11, you know, just imagine what things would look like right now.
But you did.
So it's possible.
And also, I don't agree with this because it's all, we always say this. The Marshall Plan was designed among Western nations to address the problems of devastation after war in industrialized nations. Germany was industrialized. The issues that motivated the hijackers who were in wealthy countries, Saudi Arabia is not a poor country, neither is Germany. I think we need to be appreciative that this is different. This is not Marxism. We're not talking about colonial devastation and poverty. Yes, those are factors in life. I'm not dismissing them. But I think to give an accurate understanding to help us open the door of our minds to what this era is about, it truly is about identity. It's about your notion of yourself, how you were raised, and are you fighting to defend that? I'm not dismissing the economics, but it's not, to me, in my own understanding of this, building new roads in Iraq, establishing the stock market, providing food aid, is not going to address the reasons why men leave Riyadh and go to Syria to fight for ISIS.
I think religions should be forces for peace and love. All of the religions should be that. But then there are concepts. I have not read the Quran totally, but I'm going to give an opinion here. The concept of a holy war against infidels, which is in the Quran, is interpreted by some Muslims as the infidels are the bad Muslims. The infidels are not only those that are not followers of Muhammad, but there are good Muslims and bad Muslims. Mm-hmm. And there is an infighting between the Shia and the Sunnis. And Iran supports Bashar al-Assad because he's an Alawite Shia. And Hezbollah is there because they are Shias. Very much the same way that there was persecution of one group of Christians to other groups of Christians who fortunately came to the United States and established this wonderful country, or established themselves in this wonderful country at the expense of some native populations as well. So you said before that people should fight for their convictions, for their beliefs. I would say they should never fight. They should put forth their beliefs. They can live according to their beliefs, but there should be respect for the rest. That's why I mentioned Pope Francis, because he's an extraordinary figure, a Catholic, a Pope of the second largest religion in the world, who is working for peace and for understanding among peoples. And I'm sure there are Muslim leaders who do the same. As a matter of fact, I know a couple of them, communities, specific communities. There is interreligious dialogue. In Latin American countries, there is a group of interreligious dialogue. The Pope headed one of those groups in Argentina. They promote peace, respect, harmony, humanity, because religion should be humanistic.
I'm going to connect a couple of questions that have the same theme. One part asks whether the wars of religion in Europe were due to European state formation, and another version of the question is modern and says, what's the connection between religious violence and having an Islamic state or a Jewish state or a Christian state?
Well, I think I'll just give a start here. Janet already put her finger on the Treaty of Westphalia. I would say that state formation was the result of the wars, mm-hmm. not the cause of the war. What wasn't part of it? That was part of the settlement. So it was a kind of post fact. But I still, I would still also be with Frank on that though. I don't think it's ever just about one thing. You know, we always hear about it's just the economy, stupid. But again, my message is always more complicated than that. I don't think it's ever just one thing. things are always more complex. Now, what about religious violence and state formation? Well, I mean, certainly we can point to several forms of state formation, or let's say even state consolidation. Now, or maybe I'll use this as a kind of preview of the panel tomorrow on nationalism. Right now, even after the states have formed, new nationalist rhetorics are trying to continue to form and shape those states. And some of the, around the world, some of the nationalist narratives that are still trying to form shapes or reform, or I would contest deform, certain states, certainly are imbued with religious narratives. Again, I would point to India, Turkey, Russia as three places where the continued state formation is more and more being imbued with certain religious narratives in a populist way to try to bring people on board.
As identity.
Yeah, as identity, again. But there are particular readings of Hinduism, Islam, and Eastern Orthodoxy. They're not the whole thing.
Well, certainly a place where it's incredibly complex is the state of Israel. And I'm not even going to try to unpack that, but I would recommend for anybody's reading the best book that I've read on it, because it's the only book I've read that is that really embraces the conversation. Almost every book seems to come from one point of view or another. And that's Ariel Shavit's My Promised Land. Ariel Shavit is the grandson of a founder of Israel and a progressive journalist. So he embodies a combination of things and seems to me in that book to present a balanced understanding of the creation of the State of Israel, which certainly has substantial religious overtones, and the persistence of the State of Israel, while at the same time acknowledging completely the life of the Palestinians whom the State of Israel basically displaced. You know, Steve, you said it all when you said this is complex, and it's not going to get less so.
I'd like to add something. Shavit goes to the extreme of stating that his grandfather's generation saw the promised land, the State of Israel, and didn't even see that there are Arabs living there.
Yeah.
They claimed it as their own right, and I am certainly not in the position to criticize the State of Israel. But I'm going to make a parallel. The State of Israel was created, I think, because of a sense of collective guilt of Europeans for all the crimes against humanity that they committed against the Jews. And there is not one Jew or former Jew who doesn't have a relative or more than one who was in the concentration camp and died in concentration. I think that is the origin of the State of Israel. The Dreyfus affair in France, anti-Semitism, the Zionist Congress, but at the end, it was after the World War, the Second World War. Something similar is happening in the Middle East with another group, the Kurds. I happen to defend the right of the Kurds to create a state, Kurdistan, parts of Turkey, Iraq, and Syria, belong to the Kurds. By the way, they have the brunt of the fight against ISIS, so the United States should be also supporting them. Of course, Turkey is not supporting them. But it is a very similar case. And they have a right to a state. They want a state. This is their aspiration. So, whether it is religious or cultural, religion is part of the culture, or because there are national entities that do not have a self-governing state. The modern era has recognized that these entities have a right to self-determination and self-government. Look, the division of Yugoslavia is that. It's a division along cultural, religious lines. So, yes, it's the root is the same as nationalism. I believe the Palestinians deserve a state, by the way. I want to be clear about this. I believe in the Palestinian state as a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem.
Sorry to interrupt. So this will probably be our last question. We're almost out of time. It's based on a remark that Pablo Becerra made, but it's probably answerable by anyone. The remark was that even non-believers see God as a loving being. And the questioner says, oh, but a lot of atheists don't agree with that. They think God is an evil, hateful being.
No. I said, in no case is God an evil being. Atheists simply don't believe there is a God. But they don't believe there is an evil being. That's what I meant. Even non-believers will have to admit that the idea of God, because for a non-believer it's an idea, is a positive image, not a negative.
I would take issue with that. I think I certainly know non-believers who there's a wonderful book by J.B. Phillips written long, probably 50, 60 years ago, called Your God is Too Small. And it was directed to believers saying, you know, you've put a box around God. But I just had a conversation with my brother last weekend. He lives in Denver. And for the first time, heard him say he was an atheist. I was surprised, not particularly bothered by it, but surprised. And I looked at him and I said, you remember that book? Because I knew he'd read it. Your God is Too Small. He said, oh, yeah, great book. And I said, I'm wondering whether your God isn't too small. I wonder whether the God you're thinking about isn't too small. But I do think non-believers often look at believers and say, you know, this God of yours has really screwed things up. you know, we can come back and with all the arguments we want, but, you know, the proof of the eating is in the pudding. The world is the way it is, so we got work to do.
I think it's time to give our panel a hand.